Find all the details of the 2014 program guide at the RN homepage.
G'day, Paul Barclay with you. Welcome again to Big Ideas on RN and at abc.net.au/RN. Thanks for joining me. Tonight, the importance of reefs. For most of you, that means coral reefs and the Great Barrier Reef. But we also have huge expanses of temperate reefs in Australia. And as the name suggests, their temperature is cooler, about 18 down to 10 degrees. And instead of corals, they're largely comprised of rock or shipwrecks or jetty pilings colonised by invertebrates and algae. But they're just as impressive as their tropical relatives. 85% of temperate fish and 95% of mollusks and 90% of sea stars are unique to this environment. And there are nearly three times as many species of seaweed in temperate Australian waters than there are corals in the entire Great Barrier Reef. You've all heard about the threats to the Great Barrier Reef, but our panel discussion tonight focuses on the current state of and the future challenges faced by one of Australia's greatest yet most unknown wilderness. This conversation was part of the International Temperate Reef Symposium in Perth in January at the University of Western Australia. The panellists are Professor Craig Johnson, Director of the Institute of Marine and Antarctic Studies at the University of Tasmania, Professor Sean Connell from the University of Adelaide, Associate Professor Thomas Wernberg from the University of Western Australia's Oceans Institute, and Dr. Elvira Podochanska, researcher with the CSIRO. The chair is Dr. Alastair Hobday from the CSIRO's Climate Adaptation Flagship. Now we're off to Perth, where the panel kicks off by discussing one of the most important characteristics of temperate reefs, kelp, or different kinds of large seaweeds.
Craig, you're a marine scientist from Tasmania. Can you tell us a little bit about reef systems in Tasmania?
Tasmania is basically surrounded by reef systems and kelp wherever there's hard bottom, wherever there's rocky reef. There's essentially two fundamentally different kinds of kelp bed system in Tasmania. The iconic, magnificent giant kelp forests that I think many of you will have seen photos of, the largest, fastest growing kelp in the world. That particular species has been under threat from climate change. We'll talk a little bit about that later on. And the Eclonia radiata forests. Eclonia is the species that occurs from Western Australia right across southern Australia and up to southern Queensland. So it's the most widely distributed and important kelp in Australia, but it also occurs right around Tasmania. These two types of kelp forests are extremely ecologically important, but they're also economically important. So in Tasmania, those healthy and properly functioning kelp forests support our two most important fisheries, abalone and rock lobster, worth about $150 million in terms of the beach price on an annual basis to the Tasmanian economy, which is a relatively small one with only 500,000 people. But if you take into consideration all of the downstream processing, the sort of water-to-water idea, then those two fisheries alone are worth about $350 million to the economy of Tasmania, and they depend fundamentally on the health and the proper functioning of those kelp forests.
Excellent. Thomas Wernberg is an associate professor at the University of Western Australia, and he's got a lot of experience working in the cool waters of Western Australia. Thomas, tell us a little bit about those systems.
Yeah, thank you very much, Alistair. Like Craig mentioned, Eclonia radiata, one of the types of kelp beds we have in Australia, and that's actually the only type of kelp bed we have in Western Australia. A very dense cover of seaweed on the seafloor, some places up to 5 to 10 kilograms of fresh weight per square meter. As Craig pointed out, these things are incredibly ecologically important and carries with them great value in terms of fisheries and other ecosystem services. In Western Australia, these things are found, or at least used to be found, from Kalbarri all the way around to South Australia, because we have a very extensive system of temperate reefs that run along the coastline. We in Western Australia live sort of on the interface between warm and cold water, so our kelp beds actually extend a little bit further north. But that also means that these kelp beds are particularly vulnerable because they are basically at the edge of their existence. So the northern kelp beds are really vulnerable, particularly to warming. Southwestern Australia is an amazing place for a lot of reasons, one of them being that we have an extremely species-rich temperate marine flora and fauna, and we have a very, very high degree of endemism. So a lot of species are not found anywhere else in the world than in the southwestern corner. And that's true for a lot of seaweeds. It's true for a lot of the invertebrates and fishes that live in and amongst the seaweeds.
So these temperate reefs that we've heard about in these first two cases, we've tended to think about them as the subtidal systems. But Elvira Polachanska from CSIRO has worked a lot on intertidal systems. And these are... I won't tell you what they are. Elvira, you tell you and tell us what they are.
I will do. Thank you, Alistair. So this is a boundary between land and the ocean. And in fact, animals that live in these intertidal systems have to deal with some very harsh environments. They get pounded by surf, they get submerged by the ocean, they get baked by the sun, they get rained on. It's a challenging environment for any animal to live in, but it's also a very exciting environment for us to work in as scientists. Australia has 60,000 kilometres of coastline, and half of those are temperate. So when we look at the patterns around the Australian coast, we're fortunate having a test system here where we can look at complete species ranges and look how animals and plants are responding to climate and other drivers. And our intertidal systems are probably systems that we don't think about so much. I mean, most Australians live on the coastline. We're very much a beach culture. We all spend time going down to the beach, looking at the coast, but we don't necessarily look at what's under our feet. So I say to you, next time you're on the coast, stand on a rock and actually have a look at the animals that you're standing on.
What would be some of their common names that we'd be familiar with?
Well, what we see in the intertidals is we do get a lot of macroalgae, but we're the seaweeds. But, you know, particularly this zone's dominated by barnacles and limpets and some of the marine snails.
Professor Sean Connell from the University of Adelaide. Tell us about what happens in the middle of the country there, where we're perhaps warm and cold waters are meeting also.
Well, when I jump into the water in South Australia, I really think I'm an Australian. I think gold, gold, gold. You look at those kelps down there and they just gleam gold. It's fantastic. They support a range of life. Some of the algae, the marine plants down there, we've got more of those plants, types of those plants, than we have of corals on the coral reef. They support the giant Australian cuttlefish, the Australian sea lion, and also the leafy sea dragon. All those are fairly vulnerable species, and we need to look after those habitats. And there are some pressure points in my system driven by pollution in which over the last 30 years we've lost some of those habitats. So I'm very interested in being able to assist government in turning that about.
Craig, in your experience, are kelp forests and subtidal reefs just pretty brown systems?
Yeah, not at all. You often hear the coral reef people talking about brown and boring. Well, they're a little bit brown and they're very beautiful. There's an extraordinary variety of species. There's an extraordinary variety of colour in kelp systems. The colour comes from a whole suite of different kinds of animals and plants that grow on the seafloor and the fishes that swim around in them. I used to work on coral reefs for about 10 years before I moved down to Tasmania to work on the temperate reefs and the kelp bed systems there. And various people had said to me, why would you make that change? Why would you leave the Great Barrier Reef, which is a phenomenal and exciting system, but you know, why would you bother to leave that to go to a place like Tasmania and work on kelp beds? Well, the endemism, the unique species that occur on the barrier reef is about 1 or 2%. Thomas has already mentioned the level of endemic species in Western Australia, and that's true really for all of Southern Australia. In Southeastern Australia, the unique species of red seaweeds is about 60%. That's very different from 1 or 2% of endemics on the Great Barrier Reef. And those really high levels of endemism are true for all of the different groups, not just the seaweeds. So it's a global diversity hotspot. The kelp beds of Australia are really on the global map when it comes to diversity. And that really reflects the geologic history of Australia. You know, it was 35 million years ago when Australia was parted company with Antarctica, and it's been isolated for 35 million years. That's a long time for evolution to take place. So,
Craig, do you think that period of isolation then has made those systems more vulnerable to invasive species? Is there much evidence of new species arriving into the areas you work?
In the areas that I work, I think that you know, unfortunately, they're a wonderful laboratory and example of invasive species. So on the east coast of Tasmania, we have two types of species there that are invasive. The species that are brought there by humans, usually through shipping in ballast or as on hull fouling of ships. And we have some species there that have been really very problematic, species like the invasive Japanese sea star, the Japanese kelp undaria is a kelp species that is now fairly widespread in eastern Tasmania. But the other species that have come there as a result of changing oceanography. So the pattern of the East Australian Current is now very different than it was back in the 50s and 60s. The eastern Tasmanian area is now much more influenced by East Australian Current water than it used to be. So that's the reason why eastern Tasmania, the temperature there is increasing at about four times the global average. So it's one of the global hotspots. And in addition to transporting heat, the East Australian Current also transports the propagules of species. So we have about 40, actually closer to 50 species of fish now in Tasmania that are either new records or established populations or major range extensions that weren't there in the late 1970s, early 1980s. And that's an extraordinary change to that fauna. We also have a species of sea urchin from New South Wales that is a very voracious grazer of kelp forests, and it's causing these so-called sea urchin barrens, where the urchins just come through and they graze out and they remove all of the seaweeds, all of the kelps, back to a bare moonscape. So that's a real problem. It's probably the single largest environmental problem that we have in eastern Tasmania, because we have a collapse of production, a collapse of diversity, and a collapse of those local fisheries is where those urchin barrens occur.
So that sounds like there's a fair bit of radical change happening in the southeast. On the southwest of Australia, Thomas, we've also got a current that flows from north to south. Are we seeing new species arriving also in the southwest of Australia?
Yeah, that's correct, Alistair. We're seeing a lot of the same sorts of things. We don't have an urchin that comes in and creates big barrens as they do in Tasmania, but we've definitely seen increases in tropical or warm affinity type fishes and invertebrates, seaweeds. Losses, retractions of temperate cool water species along the west coast, particularly in response to the heat wave that we had a couple of years ago.
What was the heat wave?
So the heat wave was basically a big warming event that happened in the summer of 2011, where the entire west coast, southwest coast, probably about 2,000 kilometres, was affected by this big heat pulse that was caused by an increased flow of the Luring Current, among other things, where we had temperatures that were 2 to 5 degrees warmer than normal for periods of up to 10 weeks in some places.
So it's 2 to 5 degrees warmer in here in Perth than it usually is, and people are finding that a bit uncomfortable. What happens to animals when they get 2 to 5 degrees warmer in the ocean?
Well, those that can probably move away. So a lot of the fishes move away temporarily, but when it's so extensive as it was, like 2,000 kilometres, it's hard to move far away enough. Some of the seaweeds that don't have the option of actually moving away, they basically died, and we've seen range contractions of a couple of big habitat-forming species that have left behind quite barren-looking reefs.
So there's evidence of stuff moving around on both coasts and in deeper waters. Elvira, what's going on in intertidally in terms of animals moving around?
So we're also seeing signals from the intertidal system. So actually we're quite lucky in Australia that actually our intertidal system's got a very long history of being studied, especially down in the temperate southeast area. And these are very accessible systems. You know, you can walk down to the shore and you can count and photograph and log the different animals and plants that are there. And they're also good test systems, so we can test our ecological theory with experiments on these shores. So because of this, we actually have a fair amount of baseline data. In the 1950s, there was a big effort to go around all the Australian coastlines and to log the different plants and animals, the patterns that occur along our coast. And we've actually gone back and had a look at whether some of these patterns are still there or not. And we are seeing changes. So we are seeing the warmer water species pushing further south, as Craig was saying. probably due to an influence of the warming and the East Australian current. And we're seeing things like, for example, the giant rock barnacle, which sometime in the 1980s probably jumped across to Tasmania. And we know it wasn't there in the 50s because when we read the old diaries of the scientists who are out investigating the shoreline at that time, they actually made an effort to look for this species because they were quite surprised they didn't see it. So by using all this information, we can start to understand how our shores are changing. And because these shores are so accessible, it also means that we can approach the public for help. So we have programs like the Climate Watch program that's run through Earthwatch, and if you Google those, you'll see that there is actually a citizen science program running with them. So next time you go down to the shore, we've got various animals that we ask you to look out for. So you can tick the ones that you see and submit the data online, and these will be verified by scientists. And all this information is really important for us to help understand how these systems are changing.
So all this stuff moving around, is that same thing happening in South Australia, Sean? Are you seeing new species arriving? Or what's going on?
It's not so much new species, but there's something happening with our waters. And last year we had a huge range of deaths from dolphins, seagrasses. We had fish wash up onto our beaches. Many millions and millions happened over a large period of time. You'd walk along the beaches and there'd just be thousands and thousands of fish just washed up on the shore. And our marine scientists don't know what was happening, but it was something to do with changing in the water around South Australia.
And is there ever any evidence that the waters are not as good quality as they used to be?
That's certainly the case. Our waters have been affected by just the growth of human population in Adelaide. And over the last 30 years, what that's meant is that we've been increasing nitrogen in our waters. It's a product of what we put on our gardens. It's a product of us going to the toilet. It goes out to the coast, and that seems to support these weedy species. They naturally occur in the system, but those weedy species have an unfair advantage over the kelp forests. And they turn from subordinates into dominants, and we've been losing kelp forests over the last 30 years at an extraordinary rate. In fact, the amount of seagrass we've lost, not just kelp forests, we're a real leader in that. So the pollution that we have in South Australia has been quite extraordinary, but we've got a government that actually listens to the marine scientists, and we've been doing massive equipment upgrades on our coast, and we're starting to see some reversal as a consequence of that. In the places where we've done these upgrades, we're starting to see seagrasses come back, and we're now looking forward to seeing that with the kelp.
And what do you expect some of the benefits then to be in those systems of that water quality improving?
Well, the thing that most people are really impressed by is the coming back of King George whiting. In South Australia, that's a very tasty fish. And the people who would like to invest more of their taxpayers' money would like to see more King George whiting. They're not so much interested in the kelp forests and the seagrasses. That's the end product for them. But if we can get more people to understand just how beautiful it is underneath the sea and get out there and have a look at it, maybe there'll be a bit more interest in those habitats too.
And I mean, any of the panel can help me with this one, but what's the main way that people are experiencing these temperate reefs? Craig, how do you generally see people experiencing the reefs when they visit Tasmania?
Those that are really passionate about marine systems typically will strap on snorkeling gear or scuba gear or occasionally spend money to go out in glass-bottom boats, and I think those are the people that really get to see what's going on. But for the great majority of the population, it's just when they stand and look out to sea, it's just a huge, big, flat, sometimes bumpy, two-dimensional surface, and they're really not very aware of what's happening underneath. I'm quite sure that if the population and the visitors to Tasmania could see the demise of the giant kelp forests on the east coast and could see the extent of the urchin barrens where the kelp is being wiped out by these sea urchins, if the same kind of thing was happening in the forests of Tasmania, whether in the temperate rainforest or in the eucalypt forests, if the same sort of destruction and change was taking place there, then the population would be much more vociferous and vocal about trying to look for solutions to those sorts of problems. But for most people, it's out of sight and out of mind, and it just doesn't feature on their radar screens.
Yeah. So So, you know, often people start scuba diving when they're undergraduates or entering university programs. Thomas, have you found that students are really enthusiastic about doing research in temperate systems?
Well, there's a very strong negative correlation between the amount of volunteers and the water temperature, that's for sure. but generally, most younger people are quite interested and keen to engage. And I think the scuba diving experience and getting in there and seeing and experiencing the animals and the plants is a big part of that. It's unfortunate that it's becoming more and more difficult to get particularly students out and volunteers out and participate in fieldwork, and that has to do with health and safety and all sorts of things. And I think that's a big loss potentially for temperate reefs, not just temperate reefs, but for marine ecology in general, because there's a great want and enthusiasm to want to participate, but there's a lot of red tape as well.
Right. I guess one of the benefits that you get from people participating and experiencing the environment is you get support for then protecting it. Sean, South Australia has created a whole set of marine reserves. Have temperate reefs been pretty important in the communication of the value of marine reserves?
They have. So about 90% of South Australia is a marine reserve of different levels of protection. It's great for the general public to know this and to learn more about the plants and animals underneath the water. It's encouraging. It helps with education programs. But joining with Thomas here, it's created a level of red tape in our state, which means that whilst you folk have access to the water, scientists have less access to the water, and that means more ignorance rather than more information about those places.
In terms of the management that we need to do on the shores, the other panellists talked about how there are new species coming there creating pretty damaging changes to the environment. In the intertidal zone, do you have the impression that these new species that are arriving are actually causing problems in any way?
I think for the intertidal system, what we've got is an area that's very accessible. You don't have to strap on any fancy gear to get into the water. You know, your biggest challenge there is probably just avoiding getting swept off a rock by a wave. So what we can do is, if we set up monitoring programs in these areas, we can use this as a proxy for changes that may be happening further offshore. So we can think of our coasts as early warning systems. And we can do this through science programs or, as I mentioned earlier, through some of the citizen science programs that are being set up in Australia. And actually, when you think about it, the intertidal is probably the area where we first get introduced to ocean life. When you just have to go down the shore and look at the number of kids who are out there with their buckets collecting all the interesting beasties and wondering what they're looking at.
Do you think it's because we don't eat much from intertidal zones that we don't really mind on what the species mix looks like, though?
I think it's probably a number of factors. Like I said, we don't harvest, other than abalone, we don't harvest too much from our intertidal zone in Australia. Maybe we just don't appreciate what's there. I mean, to many of us, maybe we go down to the shore and, you know, barnacles are something that stops you sort of slipping off a slippery rock as you're sort of jumping around on the shore. But actually, when you think about what these animals, you know, the environment that these animals live in and the messages that they can tell us about how our oceans are changing, they're actually pretty exciting animals. They just look very small. And
I can share the passion. It's kind of been suggested then that we have a pretty good understanding of this, but I remember growing up as a kid, I was always pretty keen on the idea that I could discover a new species. Craig, do you have any idea about whether or not there are still new species to be discovered in our reef systems in southern Australia?
Well, yes, of course there are. And I just think it's amazing when, as soon as people start to look at the genetics of some of these species, you can take a suite of animals that at first glance all look to be the same species. You look at their genetics and you realise just how many different species with very subtle variations that there are. And those species do have genetic isolation. They do behave like real species. So the whole molecular approach to defining species and to looking at this at a very genetic level has really revolutionised our idea about diversity and about the evolutionary history that's led to this kind of diversity.
I think it's the same picture that emerges every time they do one of these expeditions to describe the flora or fauna of one of the regions. It basically comes out that there's so many species that are unknown to science, and it's even big things. So it's quite obvious that there's a lot of unexplored seafloor around Australia, temperate Australia in particular.
I think it's extraordinary that the number of new fish species that are discovered in Australian waters every year, year after year after year. You know, you'd think, you'd expect that, yeah, we know what all the fish are, but no, there's new species that turn up every year.
And even one of our dolphin species was split into two previously, until recently thought it was just one species.
But we'll just digress a little bit more into thinking about what some of the future prospects are. The value of fisheries you emphasised before, Craig, again, was quite high coming out of these temperate systems. What are the prospects for maintaining fisheries yield then under the current things that we're seeing in eastern Australia?
So there are real challenges for managing fisheries in the face of some of the anthropogenic stresses like climate change, like fishing and the interaction between all of these stresses. So I've mentioned this problem of Centrus stephanus, the sea urchin, that's creating urchin barrens in eastern Tasmania to devastating effect. It's not just a climate change problem. So the climate change component of that story is what delivers that species to Tasmania. But it's overfishing of very large rock lobsters as the principal predator of that sea urchin that enables the urchin populations to build up to the point where they can have this destructive overgrazing. So that particular problem is an interaction between climate change on the one hand and ecological overfishing of rock lobsters. So if you just have the fishing of rock lobsters, there's no problem because the urchin doesn't arrive. If you just have climate change, there's no problem because the urchin arrives, but it never gets the chance to build up to create a problem. It's when you have those two things happening simultaneously that we end up with this devastating situation in the kelp beds of eastern Tasmania. So the real challenge for the fishery then is how do you manage a really important fishery in Tasmania to ensure the both the ongoing longevity of the fishery as a viable, sophisticated, modern, valuable fishery, and also maintain the ecological health of the kelp beds on which that fishery depends, by the way. So there's a very delicate balancing act there, and it's a very challenging question. It's a very challenging problem for both marine biologists and the managers who are responsible for those fisheries.
So you can be a very good steward in Tasmania of rock lobster, but I understand that you don't get all the recruits of rock lobster from Tasmania. It sometimes depends on whether or not South Australia is having good reproductive conditions because the larvae are drifting from South Australia and Victoria to Tasmania. Are you taking good care of rock lobster and kelp forests then in South Australia?
I hope so.
So do I.
Certainly the coming to South Australia, I almost want to pick up on Craig's point in that climate change, that's increasing temperature and increasing absorption of carbon into the water. That's the carbon that goes into the atmosphere that gets absorbed by the seawater, acts as a resource just like nutrients does. And so those weedy species in my system, South Australia, that benefit from nitrogen also benefit from this addition of carbon. So you can see that into the future, that those weedy species may actually gain a further advantage than what they already have. So there are many places in South Australia, and I believe this might be in many places around the world, in which we'll see these weedy kinds of species actually turn from these subordinates, well-behaved, to these dominants, which actually can create havoc as they have in South Australia.
So carbon acts as like a nutrient, and it's in short supply, is it? And so when we dissolve more carbon dioxide in the ocean, that carbon becomes available. Is that the story?
That's right. So just we've been to these volcanic vents in places like the Mediterranean, off New Zealand. I've got colleagues in other parts of the world who find the same thing. These vents actually put out carbon. So there's carbon dioxide comes out of these vents, and around these vents, they're covered by these weedy species. So there's something about these different places in the world where this happens, where we think this is the sorts of thing that might happen into the future.
In general, then, do you think there are lessons about what we're seeing in Australia that are translatable to other parts of the world, Thomas?
A lot of this, as both Craig and myself pointed out, some of the changes we're seeing are associated with the oceanography, and so basically warm water flowing south along our coasts, and that's something that happens in a lot of different places, actually on pretty much every continent. And I think a lot of these systems are good test systems for what might happen in the future, and both Eastern Australia and Western Australia, we've definitely taken advantage of that. To try and sort of work in a sort of natural laboratory, if you will, and testing some of the impacts, potential future impacts of climate change in some of these areas, or warming, I would rather say.
Yeah.
It's climate change in anything. And maybe just to take up on a point that both Craig and Sean mentioned, is that it's important to recognise that climate change isn't the only thing, and actually rarely is climate change the sort of ultimate cause of the demise of a species or any impact, but warming or increasing carbon, whatever, changes the underlying ecology of systems, which means that many systems become more vulnerable to other additional changes that might be their nutrient addition or fishing or whatever. So rarely is climate change the actual driver of an impact, but it's sort of changing the underlying sensitivity of the system, if you will.
But things are changing all the time. If things are not able to live here anymore, surely there's somewhere else they can go. So, Elvira, you know, if things are warming up and moving south, why can't they just keep moving south and everything's fine?
I guess eventually they're going to run out of places to live. So if you think about the orientation of the southern Australian coastline, there's actually, if you head south, there's not much else between us and Antarctica.
That's Tasmania.
I was including Tasmania as Australia.
Any examples yet of species that are dropping off the edge?
So we're seeing species that are going to be sort of pushed into ever decreasing areas as they're coming further and further south. And I think one of the points that's already been mentioned is that, you know, it's not just temperature that's changing. We're seeing a number of changes in our marine environment. So, for example, there's evidence that the wave climate is changing off our temperate coastlines, and waves are important in structuring some of those communities that we see.
Just in general, you've done a lot of work internationally also. Do you think that our Australian systems are in good health compared to what you understand internationally?
I would say we've got some fairly unique problem. Well, we've got some issues in Australia that I think are maybe, you know, not so much problem elsewhere. So much of the Australian population lives on the coastline. So we're seeing very large coastal development all around temperate Australia, sort of in the southeast and the southwest. And with development comes some of those other changes in the environment that have already been discussed, so sort of pollution, loss of habitat. These are factors that we're going to have to try and manage in the future together with climate change.
About 70% of Australians live next to a temperate reef, but know more or less nothing about this marine environment and the threats it's facing, from sedimentation, nutrition enrichment, development, invasive plants and animals, and, of course, climate change. Our panel tonight, filling you in, are Professor Craig Johnson, Director of the Institute of Marine and Antarctic Studies at the University of Tasmania, Professor Sean Connell from the University of Adelaide, Associate Professor Thomas Wernberg from the University of Western Australia's Oceans Institute, Dr. Elvira Polachanska, researcher with the CSIRO, and Chair Dr. Alastair Hobday from the CSIRO Climate Adaptation Flagship. You're with Big Ideas on RN and online. This is a discussion from the International Temperate Reef Symposium held in Perth.
Gary Kendrick. I work at UWA with Thomas Wernberg, and my interests are nearshore waters. And one of the biggest problems we seem to be having right now in Australia is a political turnaround about marine protected areas. And I'm intrigued that none of you actually mentioned marine protected areas. There is some talk, or so-called expert talk, that marine protected areas don't have any value to society, and it's been made at the highest level of government, at the federal level, and we're looking at closure of marine protected areas in the Commonwealth, or not declaration of them. Mm. So what's your feeling about this?
Unfortunately...
I'm happy to.
I can only answer if I tear off that bit of the bottom of my label. So I will have to direct that question. And I think I'll start with Sean, because South Australia has had a very successful implementation of its coastal marine protected areas. Do you tell the audience something about how that process was happened to actually get community buy-on?
We went through a very lengthy process where we had a consultation with communities. Most of the communities affected by this are actually regional communities, not so much those in the city. And they gave us information about where we ought to put marine protected areas. And we had a bit of controversy over this because they chose sites that they thought would be valued to the protection of marine life.
But because we had to work across the coast and have some places as sanctuary zones, which are zones where you cannot take anything, they had to overlap some of those places where they had chosen them us not to put sanctuary zones. So they also designated places where they liked to go. And unfortunately, through that process, it became a little controversial because we did overlap some of those areas just because we had run out of space. We had to put them somewhere. We got through that process, and now we've implemented marine protected areas, and it seems like people are sort of getting into it. The yield on that is likely to be different depending where you are in Australia. So if you're in an area where fishing has large effects, say on rock lobster, and that actually means that you get less urchins and kelp frost come back, that's great. But for large parts of our coast, we don't have large effects of fishing. So the yield on that will be bigger rock lobster, and we'll get bigger abalone, and we might get a little bit more diversity of fishes and bigger fishes, but it's relatively small relative to, I think, Craig's system. And Craig, I think you could say how much of a yield you'll get in your system.
Yeah, look, I think that too often the marine protected areas debate gets confused with discussion around fisheries management. So one of the really important points to make is that outside of marine protected areas, it's absolutely vital to get fisheries management right. But that does not mean that marine protected areas are therefore not required or not useful. There's a whole raft of very good reasons, very, very good social, very good scientific reasons for needing marine protected areas that have absolutely nothing to do with fisheries or fisheries management. And that's a point that seems to be too often missed in this debate. So when I think about marine protected areas, I think about the way that marine protected areas have helped us to understand the differences in ecosystem function and structure for areas that are relatively untouched versus areas where there's all sorts of marine anthropogenic effects happening, fishing and other things. And if you don't have those reference points, you can't make that comparison, and therefore you can't know how well your management, not just of fisheries, but of everything else in the marine environment is happening. As a scientist, marine protected areas are absolutely invaluable. In Tasmania, we've been able to really unravel the details of the interactions between species, and we have an understanding of the drivers of these kelp forest dynamics in a way that really is quite unique. There is no way that we could have arrived at that level of understanding and that level of sophistication in the science without being able to conduct experiments in marine protected areas, without being able to make comparisons between marine protected areas and adjacent areas that are open to fishing and all that sort of thing. And marine protected areas are well known to be extremely useful and successful, depending on their design, for the conservation of biodiversity, for example. And that's something that has nothing to do at all with fisheries. So I think, you know, to answer your question, Gary, the debate is often hijacked by the fisheries question. And we have, I think as scientists, it behoves us to make sure that we keep those debates separate and recognise that there's a whole raft of really important values and uses of marine protected areas that really have nothing to do with fisheries, and we must recognise that.
One of the criticisms of marine protected areas has been that, well, they won't stop climate change. That's just coming through anyway. But, Gary, if you pass the microphone to your left, Neville Barrett, you've had the pleasure recently of publishing a very high-profile study. Tell us about the effects of marine protected areas in preventing species from moving in from other areas as a result of climate change.
Well, I guess, yeah, thanks, Alistair. I mean, one of the things we've noticed, I guess, in the Tasmanian kind of situation is that there is often a strong interaction between fishing and climate change effects. So in Tasmania, we've had a significant increase in the number of spiny urchins that Craig sort of mentioned, and they've been very much devastating the kelp forests in the area. And not just that, they're actually influencing the whole diversity that's associated with those. So it's a large change. But in the marine parks, we've found that the natural systems in the marine parks, that the large lobsters that build up in those sort of situations and the number of predatory fish really have a big controlling effect. So they prevent those kind of impacts. It's sort of what we call resilience. The natural environment in those kind of protected areas is much more resilient to change. And that's basically led to the absolute protection of biodiversity within those parks. And if you go to nearby areas adjacent to them, the overall diversity level at a particular spot is much, much lower. So they have a very important role to play, as Craig said, not just in maintaining biodiversity in the face of climate change, but also in allowing us to understand the interactions between, you know, the fishing activities that we're undertaking and these kind of changes.
Gary, would you like to make a rejoinder? Were you happy with the panel's response to that, or you want to dig the boots into these?
Okay, I'm not going to make a rejoinder because Craig said exactly what I wanted him to say. Thank you, Craig. It's really, unfortunately, we're scientists, so we can advise based on a body of knowledge we have, and unfortunately, politics isn't driven necessarily by scientists, but loud interest groups. And it does appear that the loud interest groups have actually stolen this particular item from the last federal election. Yeah. And it's disappointing. But I think we as scientists can say it's disappointing that we are not following a democratic process that was described by Sean Connell and that's happened in this state that has lasted over 20-plus years to get these marine protected areas set up. It's been stolen by a political imperative that is only months of getting a few votes.
Hi, my name's Angela Rosson. I'm artist-in-residence with the Oceans Institute here at UWA. I'm an artist and I do biodiversity projects with children in primary school throughout Western Australia, and what I find is kids are unconnected to nature, and we've got a kind of sentimental idea about that kids are connected, they're not connected, they don't know what they're looking at. And if we can make nature the adventure land that it was for us when we were kids, we're going to have a whole new generation who won't let governments do things like wipe out marine protected areas. I think we need to educate the next generation so that we'll be recruiting scientists and people who are passionate about biodiversity.
Hey, I'm Bryn Howes. I'm a student here, a third-year marine science student. We've been on a few field trips, but it's something that I'd like to see more of. I guess it's kind of also a question is how do you engage more young people in marine science, especially at university, at the high level? Do you, like, offer volunteering things or is it part of the curriculum? But it's definitely something that would be very beneficial to young people.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there's a lot of red tape also even within the university towards that sort of thing. It's expensive to run field courses, and that definitely is a consideration when you design your course programs and things like that, and health and safety considerations. It's just getting more and more difficult to get people to get that experience, both at the university level. I mean, we're talking adult people here, I mean, but still the level of care we have to take for the students to get them out and see these things is getting to a point where it's unsustainable if we want to keep doing these things. Yeah, unfortunately, I can only see it going one way.
Yes, and I've got a 10-year-old son. I know the kids in his class. They like living in a virtual world. It's easier for the parents, and even universities are encouraging us to make sure that our courses are cost-effective and not take people out in the field and do it virtually. And recently, an award was given to a university teacher for being able to achieve that so that the students didn't have to handle the real world, but could actually do it safely online.
So online's not completely terrible, and there are some opportunities in using technology. Elvira, what's been your experience with using technology to engage people in the ocean?
Well, technology can work to our advantage. I mean, it's actually easier. It's getting much easier for us to go down and record what we're seeing in the ocean. So there probably are approaches. I mean, I found from my experience in the past that showing a recording, a video of what a reef looks like under the ocean could be really effective. I've had experience with fishers groups where I've been trying to explain just how fantastic these underwater environments are, and everyone's looking a bit glazed over as, you know, I'm rambling on, and then you sort of put on a video and it's like, wow, that's what it looks like. I think we're doing something wrong if we're not sort of introducing people to the underwater environment, virtual as well as in real life.
I think it's really a matter of just taking every opportunity to get those images, to get that experience, to get that information out to anybody who's prepared to have a look at it or engage with it. You know, whether it's through science, whether it's through art, all of those different avenues, you know, have a role to play. I really appreciate Sean and Thomas's comments about the difficulty of getting students experience in the field, but I actually think that there are sort of thresholds there, and if you can get some kind of critical mass, it does, you know, it does become easier.
Follow up on what Craig's just said, I predict that subtitle ecology in Australia will be almost dead in about 20 years' time. There might be one or two, maybe three institutions that will be able to provide that experience. It's getting harder and harder.
Can I take a question, please?
Yeah, well, my name's Paul Day, and I'm from Perth. I've been volunteering with the Reef Life Survey program since 2008, and I've met some amazing people in that time, and I've dived with some great people from all over Australia. That program has just exploded.
How does that program work, Paul?
We go out and we do subtitle reef surveys. So we lay a transect line along a reef, 50-metre-long transect line, and we survey fish species and abundance and size classes. And then we also look at the invertebrate species too, and we photograph the reef as well. So we photograph, you know, coral cover or algae cover. And that information is fed into a data set, which is used, you know, educational, and it's been used for publications, and, well, you guys know about it. But my point is that there's a massive skill set out there of non-scientists who I think is untapped. And this program has really proved that, you know, it's possible. We can use citizens, non-scientists, to collect scientifically valid data, and it can be used for the good. And I know that there's now a movement to set up a nationwide citizen science network, and I just wanted to ask the panel what you thought about that network and whether you think it could be successful.
Well, I know the guy next to you was part of the Reef Life Surveys in South Australia, and that data was fundamental to me being able to convince our state government that we actually had habitat loss on our coast. Until I was able to get that data and publish it in an international journal, different government departments would argue that the patterns that we had on our coast were just natural. The reason why seagrasses and kelps were in those particular configurations was because they've always been that way. It was the data that people like yourselves that had gathered that data that I was able to use, that we got a government consensus that then we have a problem that we had to tackle in South Australia. It was enormously helpful. People like yourself can make a big difference.
Yeah, I think there's been a little bit of scepticism from scientists that the data that can be collected from citizens and used in those programs would actually be of high enough quality. But I think our experience now on this panel and other people I know in the audience has shown that with the right kind of training and the right kind of data capture, in fact, you can get very high quality. And even if you lose some quality, what you gain in coverage is very valuable. I think the positive aspect that you point out is that the engagement of having people participating in data collection, participating in ocean monitoring, builds that empathy and enthusiasm for the environment. I'd hope that that attitude that, oh no, citizens are doing it's no good, I hope it's dead and buried amongst the science community.
And it also enables the general public to get connected with the environment in a way that is not normally possible. You know, and having access to scientists, you know, it bridges that gap. And I think it's...
Look, the traction of citizen science, I think, is just increasing globally everywhere. Reef Life Survey is a great example. It's now a global phenomenon. Reef Life Survey is happening right around the world. It's been a huge success, you know, with the few people who are driving it. I can give you another example of citizen science that I've been involved in just recently that I was absolutely astonished with. Elvira was talking about using remote instruments and remote vehicles to capture data. So one of the programs I've been involved with is the Australian underwater, the automated underwater vehicle from the Australian Robotics Centre out of the University of Sydney, running through the Integrated Marine Observing System in Australia. So that's a fantastic robot. It's a fantastic facility. We send it down. The problem is that it just takes thousands and thousands and thousands of photographs on these transects. And so the problem for us as scientists is, how do you evaluate those photographs? Well, recently the ABC decided to launch a citizen science project. We needed to just do two simple things: count sea urchins in photographs and determine, you know, the amount of kelp in a photograph, which basically there were 50 random points put on a photograph, and the people just simply had to decide whether that point was over the top of a kelp or not and record that. So the program was open for 10 weeks. How many photographs do you reckon the citizens of Australia processed in 10 weeks for something that was just sitting subliminally on the net behind there? 340,000 photographs. were processed by people from primary schools through to, you know, old age homes. You know, I would have been happy with 3,400 photographs, and none of us that were involved in that program anticipated that we would have anything like that level of response. That was an absolutely astonishing outcome for us.
Hi, my name is Maria Gonzalez. I am originally from Guatemala. I'm a PhD candidate here at UWA. I was just wondering, how is the relationship with big fisheries companies? Do they listen to science? Do they listen what you have to say, specifically in the lobster fisheries?
Look, I think it really depends on where you are. I have to say that our experience in Tasmania has probably been fairly unique, and it's been a very good experience. So there's a very tight conversation and a tight relationship between the management authorities, the industry, and the scientists. Those discussions aren't always easy. I won't pretend that for a minute. But the discussions are there, and the respect is there amongst the groups to have those discussions. I've recently worked in Europe and gave some talks there about, you know, the example of that fishery and those kind of interactions and the kind of formal mechanisms that we have in place to facilitate those kinds of discussions. And they were blown away by the fact that we could even have those discussions, that you could get those people in the room together to at least listen to each other, you know, to share ideas and to try and move forward on some of these problems and these problems of balance. Look, ultimately, most fishermen in most fisheries are concerned about the longevity of their fishery. You know, they're not all cowboys. They will want to press it and press it and press it as far as they can, but if there's really good, strong evidence from the scientists that they're overpressing it and that there's not going to be an industry there for their kids to move into or whatever, then that's the kind of evidence, that's the kind of discussion that you need to be able to have. And it's always a difficult discussion. I think in Tasmania, we've still got a little way to go, but there's a lot of success stories there as well. And if that kind of dynamic, that kind of interaction, that kind of facilitated formal process for those three groups to talk to each other can happen, then you can arrive at good and sensible decisions. And that's the way of sophisticated, modern fisheries management. It's getting the social stuff right, the economic stuff right, and also getting the ecology right, making sure that that your fishery is being supported by the ecosystem and that in the engagement of that fishing, you're not, you know, affecting that ecosystem in a way that's really, really deleterious. Look, we're heading towards 9 or 9.5 billion people on the planet by 2050. That's only, you know, it's not that far away. It's less than 40 years away. A lot of you people are still going to be alive and kicking in 40 years' time. That's like taking all the people alive in 1960 on Earth and adding them to the people who are here now. Let's put that in perspective. Seafood has to be a part of food security with that future. So we have to get it right.
Can I thank you all very much for your participation and enjoying the conversations with the panel. Thank you.
Thanks to Professor Craig Johnson, Director of the Institute of Marine and Antarctic Studies at the University of Tasmania, Professor Sean Connell from the University of Adelaide, Associate Professor Thomas Wernberg from the University of Western Australia's Oceans Institute, Dr. Elvira Polachanska, researcher with the CSIRO, and discussion chair, Dr. Alastair Hobday from the CSIRO's Climate Adaptation Flagship. That panel discussion was part of the International Temperate Reef Symposium held at the University of Western Australia. And that's it for tonight, and indeed for the week. Thanks for listening, and thanks to the Big Ideas team, Peter McMurray, David LeMay, Jim Usher, Lindy Rain, and Karin Zivanovits. I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.